From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Bev Harris and Black Box Voting. Here's what's happening. Iowa's largest newspaper is calling for an audit into the results of the state's Democratic caucus, pointing to confusion and problems at numerous polling sites, and declaring something smells in the Democratic Party. The Des Moines Register, in an editorial, wrote that once again the world is laughing at Iowa over alleged discrepancies and disorganization surrounding caucus results and called the process a debacle. The editorial, pointing in part to Hillary Clinton's razor-thin margin of victory over Senator Bernie Sanders in seeking an audit. In a moment, in a few hours, Bev Harris joins us. We'll talk about this and black box voting. Governor Rick Scott has declared a health emergency in four counties now in Florida after at least nine cases of the mosquito-borne Zika illness detected there. Health officials believe all the cases are from people who contracted this disease while traveling to affected countries. The Zika virus is supposed to be linked to brain deformities in babies and is causing concern among public health officials. The illness is primarily spread through mosquito bites, but investigators have been exploring the possibility that it could be sexually transmitted. Meanwhile, I just received an email tonight from someone who said, "Dear George, my Brazilian girlfriend is sitting here next to me and says all of the pregnant women with children suffering from the Zika virus all had a vaccination for measles, and the French news on cable did a special where they reported that. She says the French news that investigated it in Brazil says it is not the cause of the mosquito." John Rappaport, of course, is widely regarded as one of the most important investigative medical reporters in the world. John, what do you think of that email?
It's quite something. But here's the story, and I've got the breaking numbers that are just in from Brazil. You know, this whole thing started, George, with about 4,000 cases of this birth defect in babies that suddenly came out of nowhere. And so, you know, we've been on this rodeo before. The first thing that I said was, how many cases do we really have? Is this really true? And so now the numbers are emerging from Brazil, and even the major media outlets are being forced to back down because the researchers there are saying they can only confirm now 404 cases of what they call microcephaly.
It's a big difference.
Right. And of those, they can only connect vaguely 17 to the Zika virus. So this is really evidence against the whole idea that there's this massive epidemic of babies being born with birth defects. And so this is now being picked up. I've already written a couple of stories about this, but now even the New York Times is beginning to pick it up and saying, maybe, all these cases could be very much overblown. In a country of 200 million people, 404 cases confirmed of this birth defect. Meanwhile, in the United States, there are 25,000 cases of microcephaly every year. That's in the literature. And in addition to that, it's very clear, and it states, that any insult to the brain of the in fetal development could cause microcephaly. Woman falls down a flight of stairs, ingests a toxic drug or a pesticide, and so on and so forth. So everything is now being walked back. But the genie's out of the bottle. World Health Organization is promoting this whole hysteria like crazy. And there are going to be some dire consequences here.
All right, John. Continue to follow up on this for us. John's website, nomorefakenews.com. Maurice White, the founder and leader of Earth, Wind, and Fire, has died. He was 74 years old. He died in his home in Los Angeles. A former session drummer, White founded Earth, Wind, and Fire in the late 1960s. The group went on to sell more than 90 million albums worldwide, displaying a flashy and eclectic musical style that incorporated his influences from growing up in Memphis, Tennessee. The band's many hits included September, Shining Star, a cover of the Beatles' Got to Get to You Into My Life, and Boogie Wonderland. Earth, Wind, and Fire won 6 Grammys and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000. The IRS has stopped accepting, at least for now, electronically filed tax returns because of problems with some of its computer systems. The outage could affect refunds, but the agency says it does not anticipate major disruptions. A jury has awarded Apple to pay $626 million in damages after finding that iMessage, FaceTime, and other Apple software infringed on another company's patents. A helicopter pilot from Fresno County, California, from the Sheriff's Department, said that he had to make an emergency landing in a field after narrowly missing an unmanned drone at about 550 feet. The 5-foot-wide drone, that's pretty good size, came within 20 feet of striking the helicopter's rotor. The pilot said he initially climbed to about 1,500 feet to search for the drone's operator, and minutes later, the drone's owner ran out of his home, told the pilot that he had pre-programmed the drone to fly over the neighborhood. We're going to get some accidents with that. By the way, how long have you been on hold, do you think, in your lifetime, waiting for things? On hold. Here's a statistic. The average American will spend 43 days of his life on hold. Just thought you wanted to know that. An asteroid will fly by Earth on March 5th, as close as 10,000 miles to the planet's surface. That's pretty close. And now here's Peter Davenport with his weekly UFO report. Peter, what do you have for us?
Well, I've been on hold only for a few minutes here, George, but I don't mind it when I'm listening to Coast to Coast.
Good transition.
Boy, I really enjoy it when you go, you and Tom go traveling on weekends, because it allows me to get these UFO updates out of the way and leave my Friday evening wide open. So
how about that?
I'm grateful for your travel schedule.
Don't count on too many days off, though, there, Peter.
Okay. I'd like to start with a fascinating report from a commercial pilot from the state of New York. He was flying on the Sunday the 24th of January at 4:49 p.m. He reports that he was flying over Lake George, which is in the very easternmost part of New York State, very close to Lake Champlain that borders with the state of Vermont. He was flying, I gather, to the north-northeast. He looked out ahead of his aircraft and was quite surprised to see another aircraft at his altitude had its landing light on over the lake. So this pilot reports he turned all his lights on to increase his visibility to this other, what he thought was an aircraft. Over the course of a minute, George, he reports that he was getting much closer to it, and the object had a completely different appearance from what it had had a minute earlier. And as he's watching the object, he said it looked like a fluttering flag that was changing from yellow to green. And suddenly, while he had an eyeball on it, the object simply disappeared, just went away. He concludes his report by saying that in his 20 years of commercial aviation, he's never seen anything like it. That report is posted to our website for the 24th of January. a week later, bunch of reports on the 31st of January, Sunday night. First one is from West Suffield, Connecticut. Very dramatic sighting of these orange fireballs. I try to avoid talking about them, but this was so dramatic a sighting that I had to include it in my report tonight. A woman and her son got photographs, and they provided elegant illustrations of what they saw. The interesting part about this sighting, a couple interesting things, is it occurred between two major airports, Bradley Field in Connecticut and Barnes International Airport, just north of Bradley. So people at those two airports must have seen these objects. It's hard for me to imagine they didn't. But the other interesting thing is they suddenly accelerated and just disappeared in the night sky. The question with these sightings of fireballs, red and orange and yellow fireballs, is could they be sky lanterns? Clearly, in this case, it was not the case. Next morning, Tokyo, Japan, got a report from Tokyo. Four adult females on the 11th floor of the apartment building where one of them lived were shocked to see four blue-green disc-shaped objects hovering motionless
Wow.
in the morning sky. Very interesting report. That, too, is posted to our website. And just to close it off, near Fife, Washington, just north of Tacoma, south of Seattle, of course, on Interstate 5, young fellow who's an aviation mechanic was driving with his wife and their young son, age 3, and his son, from the back seat, said, "Daddy, they just turned the lights on." And he said, "What are you talking about, son?" And the son pointed over to their left, to the east side of the highway, and a bank of fog was brightly illuminated with a Kelly green light. The husband who was driving was very surprised by it, even shocked, I think. It extinguished, and then it happened a second time and a third time. I can't certify that this is a UFO-related incident, George, but just to close it out, I shared this report with a major television news company in Seattle, hoping they might investigate. Didn't even get a response from them. Ugh. It just goes to show us that these people who work for big news agencies, they ought to be listening to Coast to Coast if they really want to track meaningful news. Maybe I'll get a response from that TV station, but this was a pretty interesting case, particularly given the credentials of the witness as an aviation mechanic.
Super. Peter, thank you. We'll talk with you next week. Peter Davenport, UFOCenter.com. Have you been to Las Vegas? Well, if you have, you know about all the glitz, the glamour, the ringing of the slot machines, and just the great shows and all the hoopla out there. But how did it really start? And what went on to get it going? Fascinating story up next. Bill Friedman joins us. 30 illegal years to the Strip. Stand by for a story that will just rivet you. Let me tell you about our guest for the first couple hours here. Bill Friedman has spent nearly a half a century researching the history of the Nevada gaming industry. He has interviewed almost all the important pioneers and players. He taught that the pioneer course in casino management for UNLV's College of Hotel Administration. That was during the 70s. He was the president of the Castaways Hotel and Casino and the Silver Slipper Casino, if you remember that. It was in the heart of the Las Vegas Strip for 13 years. He transformed them from the perennial losers into super successes, consistently in the top of Nevada's highest profit per square foot performers. He's the president of the Friedman Management Group, specializing in casino marketing, design, and operation problems. And he's an author, including 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. Bill, what a book. And I've got to tell you, it's got to be one of the biggest books I've read. It's huge.
It's a major story.
I love it. When you know Vegas and the little intricacies about what's going on and who did what, it's really fascinating. And you bring it all the way back. How did you find many of the people that you interviewed for the book?
Well, I started in 1967. And so Ben Siegel, of course, was killed in 47, but all the other pioneers of the industry were still around. And when I began my research, because I dealt in Nevada at the casinos and then I taught at the university, unlike the authors that came in and wrote the sensational stuff and went home, I was kind of like homegrown. And they wanted the truth out. They were tired of everything being written. So there was very, very few people that didn't want to get involved and cooperate. All my interviews were at least 2 hours long. and some of the key figures over a period of years. My interviews ran almost 100 hours.
A couple of years ago, one of our interns here, who became an employee, and then he's not with us anymore, came up to me and said, my grandfather started Las Vegas. And I went, oh, yeah, right. And he said, no, he did. He started the Flamingo. His name was Will Wilkerson. What a story. There he was.
Yeah, Siegel bought into it after the foundation had been laid and it went bankrupt. Authors often say the name Flamingo either came because of the flamingo birds at the Hialeah racetrack, Florida, or because that was his name for Virginia Hill, which wasn't true. I went back and got the original documents submitted to the Clark County before Siegel ever heard of the project, and Wilkerson had named him that. Wilkerson had three major nightclubs in Hollywood, and they all had unusual names, like Ciro's was one of his top spots.
Yeah, he started the Hollywood Reporter and the periodical, and he loved to gamble. And Will was telling us, and we had his father on, who wrote a book about his father, and he was telling us about that he thought it would be easier, he was going to gamble so much, to gamble in his own place. And so he wanted to start the Flamingo. Great story.
Yep. And unfortunately, when he came to Vegas, he before he ever opened his place, he gambled away his bankroll at existing two hotels on the Strip.
Now, when we talk about 30 illegal years to the Strip, tell me about that title.
Well, the reason is I wanted to write a normal history of Nevada, take everything in consecutive order, and the way I was going to deal with these people's backgrounds, because most of them early operators came out of illegal gambling operations across the nation when reform would close them down. And at that point, I'd go during the licensing process and go into their history. The problem I found was that all of these guys were far more interrelated than anyone has ever realized. So you can't talk about one of them without talking about the others, because they partnered together in both legal and illegal businesses for the 30 years prior to that. The three largest prohibition gangs, and they were far, far bigger than anyone realized. I knew of key people from all three of them. And the federal government at one point, because they were buying their, they were pure importers. They didn't do moonshine. They didn't do beer.
They did the real stuff.
Yeah, they imported the finest alcohol produced in the world, the most expensive. And the number two importer, they went and based on the what they could prove was being brought into the country, and it could have been higher, the number two gang was bringing in 40 million bottles a year.
Wow.
And what's particularly amazing is all of these guys came from the poor neighborhoods, and they got the financing and built these operations because they had freighter fleets come into the edge of the territorial water, and then they had huge numbers of speedboats to unload them and head for shore and outrun the Coast Guard and pirate ships.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Joe Kennedy.
Convoys.
Joe Kennedy was part of all that, wasn't he?
Yeah, he sold to the number three gang, absolutely. But he didn't violate the law. He took it. The two biggest gangs were in Manhattan because over half the wealth of the nation lived there. And both of them were very close, even though they were competitors, and they brought it in to the New Jersey and New York borders, coastlines. The third group, a man named Mo Dalitz, headed it, and he built some incredible places later on the Strip. And Kennedy would bring the booze legally. He would have it imported from Europe into Canada,
and also bring Canadian whiskey, and he'd bring it to the shores of Lake Erie.
Hold on right there, Bill. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk more about this and 30 illegal years to get to the Strip. That's next. And welcome back. George Norrie here. Bill Friedman, our guest, author of 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. And we were talking about these prohibition violators, I guess, Bill, and they made a lot of money, didn't they?
Oh, they were just huge operations, they totally dominated when it came to importing during Prohibition. And the reason these three gangs are important, because they all three had partners, but there was seven that either those partners or their close associates ended up building the Las Vegas Strip. For the first 14 years of Prohibition, that was what they focused on. And when Prohibition came to an end, all of them went into the illegal gambling business, and they opened casinos across America, wide open, just like today, but very high end. This is a story of the elegant life of the rich and famous. These casinos were fronted by the finest nightclubs or restaurants in their area, and some of them required men to be in tuxedos to come in to gamble. You can imagine how their wives were adorned. When Ben Siegel opened the Flamingo, he was one of the partners in the largest gang. He believed the Las Vegas had a great future. One man basically owned the 5 miles we know as the Strip today, and he kept proselytizing to these other guys that this was the future. And when the Kefauver Committee led to a U.S. Senate committee that investigated organized crime, showed how they had corrupted the law enforcement across America, the local residents started reform movements, and as casinos closed down in these major areas, these guys came to the Strip. So this story is not the building of the Strip, it's the 30 years of these men's incredible but illegal business operations. And then they went on, between these seven men, they built 80% of the first Strip resorts, from the Flamingo in 1946 through and including Caesar's Palace in 1966.
And they were all mobsters, weren't they?
Yep. They were gangsters by any sense of the word, but they were an unusual group. That's why I was fascinated with them, and it's not just something that I heard about, but they brought their culture to Las Vegas, so I lived in it. Because these guys were the ones running the town at the time that I was dealing. And they were the most unlikely group of the seven men. Let me identify who they were, the largest gang. No one ever knew how these guys interrelated before. The Kefauver Committee was absolutely fabulous in eliciting all kinds of information, but they never put together how these guys tied together. And the biggest group was headed by Charlie Luciano, who was the most powerful criminal in the history of America.
Lucky, and, right? Lucky Luciano? Say more.
Yeah, Lucky Luciano. And his partners were Ben Siegel, Meyer Lansky, Joe Adonis, and a man named Vincent Allo. He did not become famous. He was one of the people I interviewed extensively. And he was known to the world as Jimmy Blue Eyes. I don't think there was anyone that knew him that even knew what his real name was. So they were the five on top. Then the number two group was headed by Frank Costello, who later owned the Copacabana in New York City in Manhattan,
okay,
which was the most famous and glamorous nightclub in America. And the third group was a man named Mo Dalitz, who was very low profile. People probably have never heard of him, but he went on. He had a great impact on me personally in my career. He went on and built two hotels on the Strip. One was the Desert Inn, which was the first great high-rolling casino in Las Vegas. And then he built the Stardust, which was not only the biggest hotel in the world at the time, but was the biggest casino. And he taught the rest of us how you run both the high-end places and the places for everybody. And he set those standards, and he had the third group. And so these are their careers. But what was fascinating about them, because, of course, I was completely exposed to their culture, all these guys were tough. Everybody that I worked for in Vegas had come out of, you know, the executives in the pit behind me, mm-hmm. as I dealt, had come out of illegal gambling. They were all tough guys. Most of them had big hearts underneath that rough shell, and they survived because it was a tough world out there. You threaten them, they would kill you, and this was to a man. But the gamblers, these seven men, were unique in organized crime because they were gamblers. And while everybody in organized crime, their goal is to separate you from your money, the gamblers are different in that while they want your money, they don't want to harm you physically. And that's why they picked this. And these seven guys, not one of them ever committed a crime except for liquor violations or casinos, except in their youth. A few of them stepped over the line, but otherwise they not only never violated them, they preached to the rest of the underworld, let's stop the violence. And they weren't talking about self-defense, but this idea of killing competitors, they said this is crazy, there's enough for all of us. They absolutely rejected vendetta. They used to just scream against it. They said all that does is create more enemies. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. And the last thing, the other major tenet of organized crime they were totally opposed to was monopoly. Organized crime gangs take over a territory, and they don't want anyone else in it. These guys were the opposite, and the FBI for years had a list of what they call open cities, where no gang dominates, anyone can come in and operate. And interestingly, every one of those cities was open for illegal gambling by either Ben Siegel or Meyer Lansky. And when they'd go in and corrupt the police and the prosecutors and the judges, and they got the okay to open up casinos, they, instead of saying, okay, it's ours, we set it up, you stay out, they were just the opposite. They called all the other major gangs and said, we're opening up a casino area. You're all welcome to come. And these guys were basically businessmen, not thinking about the greed that a criminal normally does. And they knew that a casino all by itself, even though it's the only supply of gambling in an area, never has near the revenue as if you have three or five or more places, because then it becomes a gambling center. And they knew they'd make more money by right. bringing everyone in. And to this day, those cities have multiple gangs in them all living together. They've respected that declaration of being an open city ever since.
Now, Vegas today, Bill, is definitely not like it used to be when it was formed. It doesn't seem to have that kind of mob influence anymore. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, the movie Casino was the end of the era. When those guys went down, the rest of them either got out or went down too, and that was basically the end of it at the end of the 1980s. After that, there was no influence by organized crime.
Back in 1975 in Detroit, before Jimmy Hoffa disappeared, I was talking to him. I had him on one of our shows. And, you know, he wanted to come back and take over the Teamster presidency. But the Teamsters, the pension fund, they built Vegas, didn't they?
They had a great influence on it. The Kansas City Mafia Gang, which is in another book I wrote earlier called All Against the Law, they made a pact with the Teamsters Pension Fund, and they started loaning the casinos money back in the late 50s.
Big money.
Yes, big money. They many of the places were financed by the Teamsters, and the irony was they needed this source from the beginning of Nevada gambling. Banks always considered it a tainted business, even if it was legal, and they didn't want to touch it, so they had to find their money. So they paid the Teamsters a higher interest rate than any other business was paying in America just because of this image. So the Teamsters came out very well on this because none of these places ever went under, and they paid a very high interest rate. Then what happened, since these guys arrived from the late 40s, and most of them were about 20 years old when Prohibition began in 1920, around the late 60s, going into 1970, they either started retiring or selling off. And at that point, various other gangs that had not been dominant here started getting pension loans to buy out their pension loans.
It was a great return for the Teamsters. You're absolutely right. It may have been their best investments.
Yep.
When it started falling apart for the mob, what happened? Why did it start collapsing?
Part of it was...
Was it the feds that cracked down on them? Something happened.
Oh, yes, it was all feds. It started with Bobby Kennedy when he was attorney general from about 1961 to 63.
Yet it was the mob that got his brother elected president.
They may have helped in Chicago, but they didn't need Chicago. So that's the most that they really did. It is true that Joe Kennedy tried to get the old people he knew to back his son, but there's a question of how much they really did and the most they... The only place they may have influenced the election was Illinois.
Yeah, Chicago.
And because of the Chicago gang. And he didn't need it. So, was there something wrong with it? Yes, but did they put him in office? No.
So when Vegas started changing, going from mob-owned to corporate-owned, what happened?
Well, the 70s and 80s are a real interesting group of people because you've still got some of the independent old operators around. You now have two tycoons come in, Howard Hughes, who had the biggest private corporation in the world, and Kirk Corian. You had the corporations under law could finally be licensed, and Hilton led that. And then you had several organized crime gangs in town. And you had another man who was a real character and a very dear friend of mine by the name of Bob Stupak, came from Australia, and he ended up building the Stratosphere, which of course is one of the tallest buildings in the world. So you had all of these various different types of operations going on and people. It was an incredible time to live through.
These mobsters, now when you said that they had big hearts for who, the average person or?
Yes. If you talk to anyone who lived in Vegas up before 1980, they will tell you the town was much better when they ran it. They kept everything clean. They helped people. And this wasn't stuff they told me. All the good stuff like that, other people told me about. None of them bragged about that sort of thing. They paid a much higher rate of taxes compared to what was going on than today. The tax rate hasn't gone, it wasn't higher then, but they came in with what was a very high tax rate for gambling. And they made sure that everything was run properly. And I talked to all the politicians, so when the Nevada government needed more money, and they'd go in and they'd say, we've got to do something for these things that we need, whether it was education or whatever. And the gamblers would say, this is the way we'd like to do it. But they came with the money. They didn't say, we don't want to pay anymore, even though money buys elections. They didn't say, we won't take care of everything. They were a very different breed than they've been painted out to be. And I knew of so many people that were helped by them. Before many companies had company health insurance way back when, in the very early 50s, any employee of a casino that went into the hospital, when they were to be discharged, a guy came in who had a cigar hanging out of the corner of his mouth and talked with these Dems
and paid the bill, right?
Left a hospital, they try to get you out as fast as possible, so you're usually pretty weak, and they do everything but threaten the guy's life, and they'd say, now, you don't check out, you just leave, there'll be no bill, we're taking care of it, but you ever tell anybody, and then they'd really warn them, keep your mouth shut, we don't want anything to know, and the doctors there told me, whenever we saw on the chart the person worked in a casino, we knew there'd be no bill. Nobody had any idea who was actually paying it.
No, but the bill, but some bill was being paid. It wasn't like they walked
on
it, right?
No, the hospital was reimbursed, but nobody, I never could go anywhere and find the specific sources for this money. But it was obviously the casino operators. I just can't tell you which ones.
Why the secrecy for that?
They didn't want everybody, if they got known to be a soft touch, everybody would have been at their doorstep.
Taking advantage of them and everything else.
So they kept this tough facade, this distant facade, but as I said, they truly had big hearts. There's just no end of examples I can give you of they took care of people that needed it.
Now, Luciano being one of those groups, did he not get booted out of the country?
Yes. He, and I got the whole detail of the trial record, he was framed for a crime that never was committed, was sent to prison for basically life, and then the man who made the false prosecution, and I mean he knew it was false, it was a frame all the way, rigged jury and everything, and all the details are there, that was Tom Dewey, and he was the prosecutor. He later became the governor of New York, and when he became the governor, remember who the partners were. Luciano had four close partners, and Meyer Lansky and Joe Adonis had went and investigated the whole thing, and they could prove and were about to go into court that this was a frame-up, and they went to Tom Dewey, and they said, either you pardon him or we're going to expose you.
Wow.
And he pardoned him, and you can't believe the public's reaction, because every day in the press for 6 months prior and during the trial and to the jury, he kept saying, Charlie Luciano's behind every major crime in America. That was his pitch. This is the number one criminal in America. He's behind every major crime. And then all of a sudden, he let him go, and no one knew why until my book, but it was the strangest thing in the world. There was a brothel owner by the name of Polly Adler in New York, very high-end girls, and she wrote a book about her career, and she brought that up, and she said, they convicted him on 99 different counts, none of which happened, and she said if he was 99 times guilty, why did Dewey let him go? And nobody could figure that out. And he had a great deal of problem dealing with that issue, but he had no choice.
But did they kick Luciano out of the country eventually?
Yeah, that was part of it. He was not a citizen.
Oh, he was not.
And so when he part of the pardon was a condition that he had to leave the country and never return, or he would have to finish his sentence.
Where did he go? Back to Italy?
Yeah, they put him on a ship. They never let him out. They kept him in custody, and they took him to an Italian freighter, it was a passenger ship that was headed to Italy, And they put him on board and sent him on his way.
Bill, we'll talk more. We're going to take phone calls. But what a fascinating story. 30 illegal years to the Strip.